Let's get started with this basic question about who's the West fighting with. Is it a fight between the West and Russia, China, Iran, or is a fight that the West is doing by itself? When we look at the aftermath, in the aftermath of World War II, and most importantly, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have a new sort of order, which made some sort of ideological structure in the mindset of the establishment in the West. It seems that that structure is not working anymore, is not responding to the needs of the West, to the needs, to the main objectives of the West. How do you find this? How do you find the way that they're behaving?
I think that the way you initially formulated the question, Nima, was extremely important. You said, is the West fighting against Russia and China, or are they fighting against themselves? And I think that that's very important to ponder that question, because what I believe we have in the West is a class war. You know, the way our economies, the way our financial system works, is that you have a continuous progressing polarization of wealth. So we see that now in most of the Western economies, the middle classes are disappearing and the society is dividing between the poor and the extremely wealthy. And that gap is widening. And so you start having social pressures that threaten to overthrow the current order of things. And this we saw through history now for centuries, for thousands of years, probably going back to Greek antiquity. And every time the revolutionary pressures build up to the boiling point, the ruling oligarchies always yell, "Barbarians at the gates." Because, you know, the external enemy is extremely useful to them in many ways. On the one hand, they can blame all the problems of society on the external enemy, which right now, you know, is not the Vandals, but it's the Russians. Then they can excuse the repression at home, and they can explain why we need to rearm, why we need to take on all these new trillions worth of debt in order to boost military industry, even as at the same time they're inflicting savage austerity on their domestic populations, you know, like we see in England, like we're going to now begin seeing in Germany and in France and elsewhere in Europe. And then you also, at a certain point, you send the fighting age males to war to be slaughtered en masse, because this is exactly the segment of society that is the biggest threat to you, the fighting age males that might otherwise become part of a revolution to overthrow your system of governance. So instead you say, the Russians are coming, we have to go fight them, otherwise they're going to invade here, they're going to enslave us, you know, kill your children, rape your women, and so forth. So you get rid of a lot of patriotic males, and then you are left in society with a lot of fatherless children and vulnerable single mothers. So, you know, it's so useful to them in so many ways. And then, you know, as they trigger a war, they can tell you, well, you know, your pension is gone, but blame the Russians. And, you know, maybe you can't get healthcare, but hey, you know, it's shared sacrifices we have to send. There's no food in the stores. Well, we have to send our supplies to the front lines, to our brave boys, and so forth. So, you know, yes, there's an internal struggle, and it's always the same one. It's a class war, essentially. And then that manifests into these external hostilities that are now causing Britain, France, Germany, Poland, Baltic states, this, you know, loose and let's say timid coalition of the willing to slowly start the build-up towards war. And then we had Radek Sikorski a couple of days ago tell us that, yeah, we should be prepared for war around 2030. Because that's 5 years. 5 years gives them just exactly the time to mount all this, to build up the armies, to build up their arsenals, to recruit the troops force mobilizations, conscriptions, and to train them up. The same process that they have already run in Ukraine. And this is extremely dangerous because, you know, today people are saying, well, you know, nobody's interested in fighting a war. Nobody, there's no appetite for war against Russia in any European country. Well, there was no appetite for war against Russia in Ukraine either before 2022. They implement a very gradual process of social engineering that nudges, that moves the society slowly in the direction of war and preparations. And then they trigger some event or they provoke a war in some way. They'll find a way. You know, it's the same process that played out in the run-up to World War II, the same process in the run-up to World War I, the same process in the run-up to the Ukraine war, and they're now doing it again, only, you know, not limited to Ukraine, but for the whole European continent.
Do you think that Donald Trump is a barrier for them? It's a disruption? Is somehow they feel that Donald Trump and the way that his policies, specifically in Ukraine, are he's doing, in my opinion, everything at his disposal to do something in Ukraine. How do they find Donald Trump in the way that he's behaving?
I think that for sure Donald Trump is a very, very significant obstacle to them. And we see the way European powers are now completely disoriented. They don't know how to proceed with this project Ukraine without the United States on board. So they all went into this semi-hysterical search for solution. They started talking about coalitions of the willings, conscriptions, hundreds of billions of dollars for the defense industries. Emmanuel Macron is dreaming up a big nuclear arsenal that he would be able to launch on hypersonic missiles. Friedrich Merz has quite lost the plot. I mean, what he's doing in Germany is absolutely astonishing. He's going, if he's successful, according to Handelsblatt, they're going to increase the military spending, well, infrastructure and military, let's say, but it's going to be turn out to be mostly military, and the part of infrastructure that they're talking about, as far as I understand it, is mostly these nonsensical green energy investments. They're talking about spending up to 1.7 trillion euros on this, on rearmament, which is an absolutely staggering amount of money that would double Germany's debt to GDP. It amounts to something like 20,400 euros per man, woman, and child living in the United States. And we've seen all this happen before in history, and we know where it goes. all you have to do is go back to 1961 and read Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address about the rise of the military-industrial complex and the way it completely alters the whole nature of society. And now here we have European leaders in concert, all in agreement, doing this deliberately. Donald Trump is clearly not on board. So that is a massive problem for them. I expect that they will try to lobby to change his mind. You know, they're proposing, hey, why don't you become part of the British Commonwealth? Hey, let's all be friends. Or they're thinking about destroying his administration and eliminating him somehow. So I think that all of those initiatives are on track, but it doesn't seem to me that they are very clear about where exactly they're going with this and how exactly they will proceed, because Trump also is doing his unpredictable thing that you can't really tell. Is he on board? Is he not on board? It seems that he doesn't, but he might be. The Brits suggested coming on board with the British Commonwealth, and Trump didn't say, no, that's ridiculous. I'm all about US sovereignty. He said, hey, you know, maybe that's not a bad idea. So it seems to me that they're not sure how to proceed. The only thing that they're sure about at the moment is that between now and 2030, they're preparing for war, and they're mobilizing practically all of Europe's capital and capital of future generations into that project.
Alex, when you see the role of Russia, and I talk about when I started asking you the first question, it was the in the aftermath of this collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia has somehow lost its position in the world, because we had the United States as the sole superpower just ruling everything. And Russia wanted to be part of the West. Russia wanted to be more connected with the West. Somehow, Vladimir Putin, when he came to power, Russia was devastated. Russia was totally destroyed by the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, by the way, influenced each and every corner of this world, of this planet. And here comes here you see Russia coming to its own position, the position that it had before the collapse of the Soviet Union. You see Russia connecting China, Iran. It's all about Middle East and Eurasia, as they call it. Here is what Lavrov said in terms of the relationship, today's relationship between China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea.
Of a comprehensive partnership and a strategic interaction with China are very productive. Our strategic relations with India is developing, and the deepening of friendly ties with countries such as Islamic Republic of Iran and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are flourishing.
Yeah. He says that they're flourishing, the relationship between Russia and these countries is flourishing. And do you think that Russia, doesn't matter what would happen in Ukraine and with any sort of Ukrainian settlement, Russia has decided its way to go to Eurasia, to the East? That would be their plan for the future.
Yes, that is clear, Nima. And I think that the consciousness, the awareness of the source of, let's say, the treacherousness of the West is becoming more and more clear to all these other countries, particularly to the leadership of countries like Russia and Iran and China, which are apparently very, very studious and very sophisticated, because we see that the same processes that have turned the Western civilization into this predatory, colonizing, imperialistic system are still there. So they are now, you know, they launched this project Ukraine, the purpose of which was to break up Russia and to overthrow Vladimir Putin's government and then to partition Russia. And they understand that this process doesn't stop. There is no reason for them to want war against Russia. Russia didn't threaten anybody. Russia isn't invading other countries and colonizing them. But nevertheless, the aggression, the aggression origins in the West. And it's not a question of this government of that or that government. You know, we see now Keir Starmer's government being extremely aggressive and antagonistic towards Russia. And so people say, oh, Keir Starmer, he's insane. But, you know, before Keir Starmer, there was Rishi Sunak. And before Rishi Sunak, there was Liz Truss. And before her, there was Boris Johnson. And before him, there was Theresa May, and so on and so forth. These governments change, you know, people supposedly vote, but the policies never change. They're always the same. They're constant. In the United States, we had the same until Donald Trump. And now it seems that Donald Trump's policies really are different. But who is to say that maybe in some way they will be able to eliminate Donald Trump, or that 4 years from now we're going to have another Obama-Biden type person who will then continue these same policies. So it's not about the political process in the West so much as it is in some underlying system of incentives that then percolate through the whole system and which then move the Western economies and that move Western politicians in a certain way. And we see the perfect example now happening in Britain, France, and Germany, where all of a sudden, all three nations, together with the EU and you know, Poland and the Baltic states, suddenly are on board at the same time with this gargantuan process of remilitarization of Europe and preparations for war against Russia. They're all in agreement, mysteriously, all pretty much at the same time. So it's as though the marching orders are coming from somewhere that's above. And then you can understand how the system falls into line, because, you know, in Germany, if Merz's initiatives go through, and they, you know, they've already approved 500 billion euros fund for rearmament, but it could go up to $1.7 trillion. Now suddenly you see CEOs of companies like Volkswagen say, oh, that would be wonderful if we could repurpose, if we repurpose part of our production to military uses, because from the company's point of view, the management and the shareholders, this is big money. This is government procurement contracts that are going to be able to reverse the company's slow decline. For employees, it's wonderful because instead of losing their jobs, they get to keep their jobs. So there's that, you know, like for one business cycle, this is going to actually create some prosperity. It's going to increase employment. It's going to double Germany's projected economic growth from 1% to 2%. And then you can see that all the politicians are going to try to jump on board and claim credit for, you know, economic growth. Merz is going saying Germany's back and all this. But, you know, all of these people are basically falling into line with the incentives that are given to them. But we have to focus on who is originating these incentives. And then we can see that, you know, the Western nations are increasingly being ruled by bankers. Who is Friedrich Merz? He's the former chairman of BlackRock for Germany, chairman of the board. And then the Germany's acting finance minister, Jörg Kukies, that's really his name, I'm not joking. Jörg Kukies spent the bulk of his career as a Goldman Sachs banker. That name should ring a bell because, you know, Italy had a stealth coup, removing Berlusconi and bringing a Goldman Sachs banker in power in 2011, which was Mario Monti. And then after Mario Monti, we had another Goldman Sachs banker, which was Mario Draghi. And the list of these various bankers who are in key positions where they manage the levers of power, you see more and more and more bankers. And then in Canada, we just got a new prime minister who not only spent his career at Goldman Sachs, he was also the governor of the Bank of Canada. And then in 2013, smoothly, he transitioned from being the governor of the Bank of Canada to being the governor of the Bank of England. And now he's the prime minister of Canada. And Carney is actually helpful because Carney let us understand how all this works, because he got named as the UN special representatives for climate change. And in 2019, I think, or maybe 2016, I don't know, a few years ago, he gave an interview to Bloomberg TV, where he also happens to be on the board of directors. And they asked him, well, you know, how are you going to save the planet from climate change? And he flat out said, well, you know, we're going to look at all the companies and their initiatives and how they intend to transition their, you know, from, you know, hydrocarbon burning business to green energy business and all this. And he said, we're going to solve it by taking credit away from those who are part of the problem and giving credit to those who are part of the solution. This is an extremely important statement and a revelation, because it admits that these high-level bankers can and do direct the development of our society by allocating large amounts of capital to certain kinds of businesses for certain kinds of purposes, you know, whether it's pandemics or climate change or wars. So now we see hundreds of billions of dollars being allocated to wars. And I think that Carney gave us a good indication about where those decisions originate. They originate at the very tip of the pyramid of the global financial establishment.
Alex, when it comes to the conflicts in Ukraine, in the Middle East, and maybe in Taiwan, I always ask myself what Russia could have done to avoid the war in Ukraine. I found nothing on the part of Russians. They have done everything to avoid the war in Ukraine. And right now, we have the same situation between the United States and Iran. On one hand, we see Pete Hegseth talking about, we don't let Iran to achieve nuclear weapons. And on the other hand, we know that the Bill Burns, before leaving Washington, the CIA director under the Biden administration, said there is no, Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons. And right now, the intelligence report under the Trump administration, Tulsi Gabbard, is reporting on that the same way that Bill Burns was. Here comes the question, what these countries can do in order to satisfy the mindset of these people in Washington? Because it doesn't matter. After all, it seems that this sort of hegemonic mindset is deciding about everything. It's not about the way that China is behaving, Iran is behaving, Russia is behaving. Do you think that sort of mindset could change under the Trump administration? Do you see the possibility of that sort of change?
You know, if you asked me this two or three weeks ago, I would have said yes. Today, I'm not so sure. The colossal, unforgivable blunder of bombing Yemen and everything that we learned about this tells me that this administration is not clear about what they want to be, who they want to be, what they want to represent in the world. I think that their strategic decision is, do they want to continue being an empire, or do they not want to continue to be the empire? In which case, they have to waste no time to roll back their imperial engagements around the world. Because everywhere where they are, there's a danger that something is going to break out, and then fight's going to escalate to the point where they're not going to be able to control it. Now we see that, I saw this from Scott Ritter, that the United States has made very significant deployments to Diego Garcia. 7 B-2 bombers, 10 KC-135 tankers, I think these are refueling aircraft, and a number of C-17 cargo flights that are going in and out of Diego Garcia, and then an Ohio-class ballistic missile submarine has been deployed to the Indian Ocean. So it would appear that they're gearing up for an attack on Iran, or at least they're giving those signals. Now, it could be conceivably that they're doing this in order to, let's say, pressure Iran into some kind of an agreement, a deal, on favorable terms to the United States. But I think that they live in the past. They still think this is the 1990s, you know, Black Hawk Down, the indisputably most powerful military that cannot be defeated on the battlefield. You know, this basically fiction of overwhelming power, but this is no longer the case. And so I don't see where the administration is going. I'm not even sure that this is a deliberate strategy. It seems to me that they're just kind of drifting along the well-trodden paths. We do this because it's what we've always done. We know how to do this. We have this big military. We can use it. We can intimidate anybody into submission to our diktat. And we have this whole big giant voting block of very passionate Christian evangelicals and Zionist Jews who expect this of us. So, you know, we're going to make all those signals, send the message so that people take us seriously. This is not the 1990s. The Yemenis, the Ansarallah, heard you loud and clear, and they didn't get intimidated. They started shooting at you. And yesterday, the Yemenis commented, well, they say that they intercepted all our drones and missiles launched at their ships. Ask them to send us recent photographs of their ships, recent footage. So we're waiting to receive that. apparently, you know, the Yemenis are quite confident that they struck some of the vessels. And in that case, there's going to be a lot of soul searching at the Trump administration. And it doesn't seem that they know what the hell they're doing.